Welcome to the University of Exeter's Research with Impact podcast. We're joined by Professor Callum Roberts, who is world-renowned for his research into protecting global marine life. As well as being an award-winning author, a WWF UK ambassador, and the chief scientific advisor for the BBC's Blue Planet series, his marine research underpinned the global 30 by 30 ocean protection target. Over to Professor Roberts to hear how through collaboration, shared objectives, and a commitment to implementing the strong protection of nature, we can secure a healthier planet for everyone.
I'm Callum Roberts. I'm Professor of Marine Conservation in the Centre for Ecology and Conservation at the University of Exeter. I'm particularly interested in the effects that people and human activities have on the ocean environment. And knowing and studying how much people have impacted the environment over time, I'm very interested in finding ways in which we can better manage those places and ecosystems so that we minimize the impacts and maximize the benefits to all of us. At the University of Exeter, there's a very wide range of people undertaking a fantastic variety of investigations into marine life. And we range from molecules through microbes to whole whale-sized organisms and from individual species to entire ecosystems. I think one of the things that really sets us apart is that ability to examine and scrutinize nature at all levels and use that to piece together an understanding of the lives of individual species and think about how that contributes to the functioning of ecosystems. And by understanding both ecological and evolutionary processes and how human activities are affecting natural environments, we're able to look at all of the forces that are shaping the natural world simultaneously. At the university, we have a huge variety of studies going on, and they range from individual studies of organisms like penguins or tunas, understanding what drives these species to do what they do, thinking about the behaviors of these creatures, and how environmental and human influences affect those behaviors. We're also, of course, very invested in looking at the structure and functioning of ecosystems and how those have been altered over time by human activities. And one of the things that really sets us apart here is a focus on conservation and management of the natural environment. And we have a fantastic variety of approaches which are being deployed to find out about these different ecosystems. And so that involves technologies that are being piggybacked onto birds and fish and marine mammals, for example, so we understand their behavior in the wild. And it also involves a great deal of direct face-to-face interaction with places in the field. You know, field study has been a linchpin of Exeter research for a long time. And in particular, we're quite keen to go back to the same places again and again to build a more and more detailed understanding of how those ecosystems function that we're studying. One of the things about research is that it's absolutely fascinating from the selfish perspective of a researcher. If you're a scientist, you love to go out and find out things. But in today's world, the planet is changing so fast and in so many different ways that we really need to understand what are the adverse effects that people are having on planet and environment, and how can we address those through doing things differently. Now, the kind of research cycle goes that you get a grant, you study something for a period of time, you write a paper, and then you move on to something else. But that's not the way in Exeter. Really, what we do is we are committed to going beyond the publication, to making sure that the insights that we publish about ecosystems are made use of by people who are dedicating their time to creating a better world, to managing it better, to protecting nature, to maximizing human welfare from natural environmental products through things like fishing. And so to do that, you know, we don't have the time to do it individually, but what we do is we partner with organizations and people, often conservation bodies or governmental agencies or organizations, so that they can take the findings directly from our research and put them into practice through changes in practice or policy. EXTA research has had many influences around the world. We work in a whole range of different countries. For example, several West African countries in the Caribbean, in South Africa, in the Indian Ocean, in the Maldives, for example, in remote Atlantic islands. And in every case, we're working with local partners. We are forming long-term relationships with them so that the research that we do is able to have an impact in those places. At the same time, we're also having an impact at larger international and global scales. So, for example, research that we've undertaken has looked at how much of the sea should we protect from exploitation and harm to safeguard biodiversity on Earth. And the answer to that has been built up over time and through many publications and has been then gradually embedded into international policy. And just at the end of last year, the insights from that research that we should be protecting about 30% of land and sea were adopted by the world community at the Convention on Biological Diversities. So we actually, you know, began that research when nobody else was looking at how much of the planet we should protect. You know, people were studying individual protected areas and looking at what they did. But that question, that bigger question, we've chipped away at it over a very long period of time and finally have seen the fruits of that research ripened with this influence on international policy. In Montreal, at the end of 2022, the world adopted a new target for the protection of wildlife and places in both the sea and on land. And that commitment is to protect 30% of all the world's terrestrial and marine ecosystems, and it's been dubbed 30 by 30. I've been studying marine protected areas for many decades now, and the best kind of insight you can get into how a protected area works is to go to the same place again and again. And what you see is that over time, the benefits of protection build up and accumulate. You know, it's like compound interest in a bank account. It starts slowly and it's subtle. The effects are subtle at first, but then gradually, you know, you see this huge increase in the abundance of wildlife. Caves fill up with fish. The fish get larger. They become more brazen and out there in the open. And so we can see that protected areas really work. And insights from our research have shown that the benefits of protection are proportional to the investment that we make in protection. So if you were to just give a little bit of protection, you'll only get a little bit of benefit out. If you give a lot of protection, then the impacts on nature are enormous, and you see wildlife really bouncing back after decades of decline in many cases, and ecosystems themselves begin to rebuild over time. And it's only by going back to the same places again and again over many years that we can really piece together this picture of recovery. Knowing that ecosystems can recover like this, we're able to then make recommendations to national and international bodies that are dedicated to the protection of nature. And we can say, you know, if you protect an area in this way, then you can expect this kind of outcome, whereas if you're doing it differently, then the outcome is going to be different and it may not be what you want. You may have to ramp up the level of protection. I think one of the things that we've seen recently is that the focus is shifting now. We've now got a target of expanding the world's protected area networks to 30% of the planet. So the focus on quantity is still there, but now we also need to bring in quality. And so good protection, good engagement with local communities and stakeholders who ultimately are the arbiters of whether or not a protected area will work in the field. And that's one of the things that EXTA Research has been particularly good at, is looking at how communities influence the outcomes of conservation. And, you know, good outcomes come from intensive processes of community engagement to develop shared goals for nature and for livelihoods. So with all the right things in place, you know, engagement with local people, shared goals and objectives, and a commitment to implementing strong protection of nature, then we can get the best outcome for everyone. I think the first time that I began to study how much of the world should be protected was in the late 1990s when I was part of a working group, an international working group on marine protected areas. And at that time, very little had been published on it. And so what we had to start thinking about was, you know, what was the primary research we needed to undertake, and what research had already been done that we could bring to bear on answering this question. There were a handful of papers at the time, and so it was something, it was a question that we needed to come back to again and again, and approach from both theoretical directions, thinking about developing models of the way that the ocean environment works and how you scale up from benefits that are in individual protected areas to networks of protected areas to whole ocean scales, and also looking at the outcomes of protection in particular places and how that multiplied the abundance of nature and the variety and protected the variety of nature. And so it was really a kind of collective endeavor eventually. And we've gone through multiple research partners over time who have each contributed a little bit to answering the big question. That then has finally been adopted. I think that the strength of the research is in the fact that we stuck at it for a very long time to get robust answers that were credible to non-scientists, to policymakers, and that they would be willing to pursue in the international arena. Now, one of the things that you want to know if you are interested in how better to manage the environment is what animals and plants are doing in the environment. And with animals, you know, some of them are extremely mobile. So, for example, in recent decades, a fish that was formerly abundant, then became scarce, is now becoming more abundant again as a result of better protection, and that's the Atlantic bluefin tuna. And they have been extremely valuable in fisheries, and that's been their downfall over time. They've just been too valuable to leave in the sea, and we've taken too many of them. But with international pressure and good research, the managers have decided to fish less. That means the animals are becoming more abundant. They're showing up on the Cornish coast again for the first time in decades. And to understand their lives, we're putting electronic tags onto those tunas and finding out what their movements are. And so then we can understand, you know, what is the scale of a single population? At what scale should we manage that fishery so that it is going to be sustainable over the long term? And at the same time, we're understanding fascinating things about the biology of individual tunas. We're also putting tags on things like penguins and trying to understand the reasons for the decline of the African penguin, which has undergone a dramatic population decline. It's going in the opposite direction to the bluefin tuna. And we need to know why. And there's controversy in South Africa over where the fisheries for sardines are competing with the penguins for their preferred food. And by studying the energetics of penguin foraging behavior, by looking at how far they have to travel to find food, how much energy it costs them, we're able to understand better what management needs to be done to bring this population back. And it turns out that fishing, of course, is having an impact on penguins. And it's controversial because the fishing industry would rather not consider penguins in what they do. But obviously, there's a whole group of people who are very invested in this iconic bird. And it's very important to South Africa. So we've got to find a balance that is going to protect the penguin and maintain the productivity of the fishery. Well, there are many pieces of research that we're undertaking, and each of them has its own challenge. One recent project that we've just taken on across a wide range of academics at the University of Exeter is the Convex Seascape Survey. And what this survey is aiming to do is to find out how we can better harness the power of the ocean in addressing climate change. One thing we know is that the ocean is an enormous store of carbon. And when carbon is deposited and locked away in ocean sediments, then it's not causing any further contribution to global warming. You know, that carbon in the atmosphere causes the Earth to warm, but when it's in ocean sediments and locked away, it's not problematic. What we know is that human disturbance of the sea is causing the resuspension of those sediments and potentially re-releasing carbon, which will find its way into the atmosphere and accelerate global warming. This big consortium of Exeter academics is focusing in on this big problem. What is the influence of human activity on ocean carbon stores? If we find out that there is a big impact of people on carbon, let's say by disturbing the seabed through dragging trawls or dredges to catch fish and shellfish, then there's a policy lever that governments can pull. They can say, you know, no, we're not going to fish with these methods anymore. We're going to protect the carbon stores instead, because that's the most important thing. You know, we can't afford to mobilize them. Just as we can't afford to cut down rainforests, we need to harness their potential to keep carbon trapped. That's bringing together a very wide range of different disciplines across the university. We've got global biogeochemical modelers. We've got marine sedimentologists and geologists. We have biologists who are interested in the animals that live in the mud on the seabed. We've got historical ecologists who are thinking about, you know, what were the earliest influences that we've had on the sea and how have they changed over time? We've got geographers who are mapping current human activities around the world and how they influence the sea. So all of these different disciplines are coming to bear on answering this one big problem. And I think that incredible strength of that is that we are able to cross the boundaries between disciplines to make the answers that we get much more powerful and convincing in the end. When we were putting together this proposal for the Convex Seascape Survey, we looked at what disciplines we would need to represent to be able to answer the problem properly, the question of how much impact human activity was having on ocean carbon. And we didn't have to look very far to find almost all of the skills and expertise that we needed within Exeter across the two campuses. And so the core of this project was built around Exeter expertise, and then we went to other institutions, the National Oceanography Centre, Plymouth Marine Lab, Bangor University, King Abdullah University in Saudi Arabia, University of British Columbia, to bring in the world-leading, world-class experts to complement what was an incredible team built from the inside out. Exeter research in the marine environment has grown enormously in the last decade, and we are building our reputation around the world. We are seeing greater representation at scientific conferences worldwide. We're seeing representation on expert panels and in international fora. One area, for example, that we have been influencing is negotiations at the United Nations around the establishment of a high seas treaty to protect wildlife beyond the limits of national jurisdiction. So countries have sovereign control over the sea to 200 nautical miles offshore, but the rest of the ocean is international space, and management there is particularly weak, and it's like the Wild West in these waters. The United Nations is busy trying to create rules and norms that will allow us to protect wildlife and biodiversity there more effectively. Our research has been really influential, feeding in through non-governmental organization partners that we have, like the Pew Charitable Trust, for example, and Greenpeace, to try and influence the shape of the negotiations, the kind of provisions that go into the treaty to make sure that it's strong enough. And that research has been shared as it's been created with the decision makers themselves and the national delegations who are actually undertaking the negotiations. So almost in real time, extra research has been feeding into that process. And so I think we will see a considerable influence and imprint of that research ending up in what is finally decided by the United Nations. I have been working with an organization for many years now called Blue Marine Foundation, and they were founded in 2010 as a consequence of a film that I participated in called The End of the Line, and that was based on a book by a journalist called Charles Clover. And he, together with the filmmakers, created this conservation organization, not wanting to leave this as just a movie saying, oh dear, the oceans are going bad. They wanted to make positive change. And so this organization was formed that was dedicated to ocean protection. It's grown enormously over the years. I've been a trustee since the outset. I've been their chief scientific advisor since 2019. And at every step, I'm delighted to see the insights from our research being used directly by all of the staff in building their conservation programs, in bringing expertise to bear on the design of new protected areas, on the management measures that people are devising for those protected areas. And we continue to work with them. We continue to support postdoctoral researchers, PhD students, who are using the best techniques available, the latest methodologies on problems that have practical significance for conservation in the field. And so it's a very much a symbiotic relationship between us, is that they pursue protection and policy change to safeguard the ocean. We understand the ocean better so that we can manage it better and make recommendations as to how to go about doing that. And so by working together, both sides of this partnership have greater success. One thing that we discovered over our studies of marine protected areas in the wild is that by protecting a place from exploitation, from fishing principally, you get more fish, you get more shellfish. That doesn't then mean that that's taken away from the people who catch those animals. In fact, building up stocks of fish inside a protected area leads to better fishing outside the protected area. And the reason for that is that there is something going on called spillover. So as conditions get more crowded in a protected area, so animals start moving out into surrounding areas that are less crowded, and that happens to be because they're fished. And so you get better catches around successful and well-functioning protected areas. And those animals inside protected areas grow bigger, and bigger fish produce many times more offspring, and those offspring drift away on ocean currents. So a protected area is like a fountainhead that is supplying offspring to much, much bigger areas. And we discovered that just through doing relentless research, going back again and again to the same places, studying the fishery as well as the fish, and looking at how people were interacting with the protected area over time. One fascinating thing is that a phenomenon begins to develop around successful protected areas called fishing the line. And that's because fishermen move their boats or their traps or their nets closer to the protected area to take advantage of this spillover. And fishing the line really indicates that a protected area is working well. All the traditional technologies of ecological science to understand the way that the environment works, so pencil and paper, binoculars, scuba tanks, and masks. And those techniques form the backbone of a lot of our research. But we're also then applying new technologies as they emerge to solving problems in new ways. And so, for example, we're looking at environmental DNA and ancient DNA to ask questions about the structure of present-day ecosystems and how that's changed from ecosystems in the past. We're using increasingly miniaturized electronic tags to be able to track the physiology and the behavior and the location of wildlife from birds to fish. And these technologies are giving us insights that we just couldn't get a number of years ago. One of the things that we're doing in the Convex Seascape Survey is that obviously this project is dedicated to trying to find ways of increasing the power of the ocean to take up carbon emissions that that people have been pumping into the atmosphere. But in and of itself, research creates carbon emissions. And oceanographic research from big ships is very carbon intensive. And one of the things that we've set out to do from the beginning is to monitor what carbon we are burning in the course of undertaking our research, and by accounting for it, try and find ways of reducing the environmental impact of the research itself. And quite surprisingly, there are very few universities that are actually doing that at the moment. And we hope that our research project will become a model for others to follow to try and limit the global warming impacts of the research itself.
Thank you, Professor Roberts, for a really insightful podcast about the huge variety of research happening in our marine environments. If you want to learn more about the University of Exeter's groundbreaking research on fundamental global issues and how they're leading us to a greener, healthier, and fairer society, please visit exeter.ac.uk/research.